This is Scott Becker, and I'm thrilled to have Micheline Davis on again. Micheline is one of the brilliant people in our country, and she's going to talk today about health equity, diversity, issues that can really be challenged in a pandemic and crisis situation, and no one better than her to speak about it with us today. Micheline, can you take a moment to introduce yourself, and then we'll get into a number of issues about long-term impact, health equity, community level, provider level, and so forth.
So thanks, Scott. And again, thank you so much for having me, and more importantly, for wanting to introduce and discuss this particular topic. I'm Micheline Davis. I am Executive Vice President and Chief Corporate Affairs Officer at RWJ Barnabas Health, the largest academic medical center system in the state of New Jersey. And there I oversee a variety of areas, chief among them is policy and government affairs, and also social impact and community investment, which is really driven by policy through an equity lens, which brings us here today.
Thank you. And talk to us about how a crisis impacts health equity and diversity. Take us through some of that.
Yeah. So thank you so much for the question. The coronavirus pandemic really have been touted by many individuals who were very well-intentioned, I'm sure, as the fact that this was the great equalizer. And I'm certain that what they meant by that was along the lines of really the way in which it affects everyone, right? No one can earn their way out of this. You can't be educated, you know, out of this, and that we are all vulnerable. I think that the difference there is that it isn't the great equalizer, because quite frankly, inequities that had existed for generations were such that it really is just a great magnifier, right? It really just places an incredible spotlight on what so many of us in the health equity space really already know. And that is that as a result of decades-long policies and laws and regulations, that quite frankly, so many within our communities were already in a position of disenfranchisement, which was going to render them that much more vulnerable than not, right, than others. As a result of that, what we're seeing right now in the midst of this pandemic is that being borne out. What we are seeing is the fact that we are literally seeing incredible unemployment claims, which I'm certain are affecting lots of communities, but then we're seeing pockets of demographics that are impacted all the more. And so when we start talking about why that is, what one of the things that folks first looked at, of course, was the fact that, well, it's impacting the elderly population differently and so much more significantly. But there were another aspect of that very early on, when what we understood was it's not by virtue of whether or not you receive an AARP card in the mail. It is by virtue of whether or not there are also, right, other underlying conditions that will contribute to the complexities of what we are seeing. And that there are certain demographics which unfortunately have more of these underlying conditions at much earlier stages in life. It reminds me of Dr. Iton's statement that your zip code is a greater determinant and predictor of your lifespan than your genetic code. So certainly, if you have resided in one of these communities that unfortunately, as a result of decades of redlining and zoning, which disproportionately negatively impacted your environment. And so not only were you prohibited as a person that was Black or brown to move to other sections of town, but quite frankly, that you were targeted to live there. And then it was literally drawn on a map to be on the other side of those railroad tracks, and also placed within the same proximity as environmental pollutants, like the town incinerator or the tire factory or anything else along those lines, you're going to have greater evidence of everything from childhood asthma to, quite frankly, those same communities wound up being the same areas that were also without adequate and appropriate and affordable access to healthy housing and healthy and nutritious food. And so you're going to see other outcomes as well, right? Higher rates of childhood obesity. And what do we see when we take a look at the pandemic, right? We see that individuals who have a higher BMI are actually suffering at a disproportionate rate. And I think that we're going to see so much of this, so much more as we go forward. That's the reason why when we begin to talk about the need not to just to reduce, but to eliminate healthcare disparities, why something like this pandemic really places such an incredible opportunity to really have this discussion. As we take a look at really what it is that we need to do differently, Scott, I think that we're brought into an environment with a higher level of understanding, I hope now, and a deeper ability to really look at the data, scrub it, and recognize that it's not even something that's just in the instant. It's really going to be that which requires systems change. You asked a great point when you talked about health equity and then diversity as well. Well, one of the things that we are always hoping for is the fact that leadership teams and those rendering policy and really are comprised of diverse individuals, but with an inclusive mandate, because ensuring that they are at the table and with the opportunity and their perspective of being able to bring everything from, of course, their knowledge and know-how from their background and education, but also a real-time lived experience, I think would have evidenced much earlier on some of the issues that later we were able to see so readily as a result of the pandemic, really, right? That there were going to be certain populations that were likely to be workers in the essential service area than others, right? Not just police and fire, but if we were going to determine that grocery stores and service and delivery, right, that we would understand that there are going to be pockets of individuals from particular communities that were going to be more impacted than others. And that in so doing, just kind of even everything from who would be tested and the questions that they were being asked, you know, whether or not you've traveled internationally most recently, there's going to be a larger and higher percentage of perhaps those who have more easily readable access to disposable income than others. And so as a result, oftentimes, especially because testing and test kits and screening kits are at such a premium, quite frankly, right, they were denied testing very early on. So from even those types of policy decisions to literally the opening up of testing sites, lots of them were placed in very suburban areas. It sounds great, right? Just get in your car, you know, drive there. Some you need a referral for a physician and some you don't. But it does require a car, right? And so those
you mean 100%. So you end up in a situation where the social determinants of health that are talked about so much and so challenging to address end up having an absolutely critical negative impact when you have a horrendous virus that ends up being harsher on people that have more pre-existing conditions of all sorts. So if people are more likely to have asthma, they're more likely to have hypertension, they're likely to have a number of different conditions that come from being in sort of very difficult areas, like you mentioned on the zip code being the biggest determinant of health. It's if they started in bad zip codes, then they're in a spot here instead of this being a great equalizer. And in fact, attacks are most vulnerable, is really what happens. Micheline, what's some of the long-term things that have to be done to change this? Because it's not just at the health system level. There's a lot of health system to do and being focused on and being thoughtful about it. But it goes beyond that, doesn't it?
It does, Scott. You understand this so finitely and so delighted to hear even the way in which you frame your thinking in the space. It really does. I think that there are reasons why, you know, at the federal level, there's been a bill that's been introduced in order to take a look at this and to really examine the data that gets collected. It has a lot to do with the way in which these communities will need resources in order to shore them up. In my state, in the state of New Jersey, our governor just signed an article of legislation requiring reporting of demographic data because quite frankly, both the demographic data then layered with the geographic data is going to help us to better understand really the actions of our policies. So you're right, it is not enough. I think it was Bishop Tutu who said it's not enough to just keep pulling people out of the river. It's important to figure out why it is that they keep falling in. So what I'm hopeful of is that this will require us to take a closer look really at what's going on in our communities and how it is that we need to shift and change in order to ensure that these communities have an opportunity to rebound. Everyone is excited for whenever that opportunity is, when the nation gets back to work. I don't say get back to normal because I don't know that any of it has been normal, right? To have such a disproportionate amount of individuals so incredibly vulnerable at any point in time does not need to be a normal that we return to. I think that you're exactly right. Take a look at our supply chain and the disruption that occurred globally. Well, a lot of this, I think, will encourage us to do more of what we term anchor mission work, which is to really make certain that we are bringing manufacturing back and perhaps shoring things up right here on the ground in order to ensure that you know, PPE was so desperately needed. You know, we're talking about, you know, some plastic and some thread and whether or not we can really make certain that these communities then are given opportunities to create some economic stimulus right there in a manner that is equitable would be something that I think would be incredibly helpful. But there are much longer term issues that we would think and talk about. And a lot of them have to do with the policies that would need to be created in order to ensure that we do not leave such large proportions of our country behind.
Right. And it's really a complex political issue because you really do need people on both sides of the aisle on board with a little bit less manufacturing overseas, a little bit more here, and maybe a lot, both for supply chain issues, but also job issues and good job issues for tons of different reasons. It's a fascinating discussion. Another question for you is, how does this get impacted positively? You know, what, I mean, you've mentioned something that's fascinating, this equalizer concept. And what you see going on right now is the stock market's recovering somewhat. Jobs are not recovering at all yet. And this is a great disconnect in America because there's only about half of the people in the country, some percentage, that have interest in the stock market. So stock market correction is meaningless to half the people, but job corrections are very important. How do you sort of impact some of these things positively in the long run? What can be done?
So I appreciate that. I think that we're going to really have to be incredibly innovative in how we approach so much of this, Scott. At least in our industry, we immediately said, well, this is the time for telehealth and telemedicine, right? I think that's great, but I think that there were lots of other issues that folks kind of left out, and also that had a lot to do with, you know, who has access and who doesn't. We saw school systems that began to immediately go online and then realize, I know that there's one in a particular town in my state that 90% of the children do not have internet access at home, right? So it's going to require us to really have a take a step back in order to ensure that the most vulnerable are literally cared for, right? The disabled community was hard hit as a result of this, right? We really need to make certain that as we begin to shape how we go forward, that it is in a way, and I understand completely, right? I check the stock market daily. I truly do. But we also have to make certain that we're thinking about those who are at the different points in along the scale in reference to what we need to do. I think it was the Curb Effect written by Angela Glover Blackwell that talked about, you know, if you take care of the least of these, then quite frankly, everyone else benefits. But when you take care of only the elite, then only the elite benefit. I think that when we take a look at numbers put out by entities like the Economic Policy Institute that talked about the fact that their projection that by July 2020, if things don't turn around pretty quickly, the unemployment rate will hit nearly 60% higher than that of the Great Depression.
Right, and this is the fascinating situation of, you seem to have politicians in some countries that seem to do a better job of trying to understand there's an entire balance of things we have to work through. I think of Angela Merkel, who says so eloquently, look, this is brutal and we have to deal with it. We also have to figure out how we actually pay for everybody as well and take care of everybody. And here you have this great disconnect, it seems, on both sides where they don't seem to address that. I mean, you mentioned this issue of people that are pro-lockdown and pro-homeschooling. At the same time, they're not even aware that for a huge percentage of us, poor communities and non-poor communities, the internet doesn't work like that. It's not even doable, this homeschooling. It's sort of it's a facade. I mean, it's not actually happening. And it's particularly acute at the lower income levels, but it's every place where it's a debacle. And there doesn't seem enough empathy for that at any level of government. You've got a political federal level that seems to be sort of out of sync with the country, and you've got a local level that seems not really in sync either with some of these real problems and issues of what that really means. We have a magnificent mayor in Chicago who's very attuned to the fact that closing down the schools in Chicago causes lots of harm for lots of families. I mean, she actually is very, very understanding of it. But you don't have a lot of that, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. When folks sometimes ask me what's the number one issue that you can do for your health traditionally, Scott, I say vote. And so much of that really deals with exactly what you're talking about, who's in those seats rendering those policy decisions is going to make such an incredible difference in the outcomes of the health and well-being, not just of your family, but also of the community. I think one of the things, you know, you asked earlier, you know, so what can be done? I think that we have to stop looking at certain issues or certain resources for those who receive some type of government subsidy. You mentioned, you know, children in schools, and I think of SNAP, and I think of, which is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and the way in which, quite frankly, we need to really figure out how do we streamline access between programs that have similar income eligibility guidelines, right, such as Medicaid and SNAP, and then have as many states as possible maximize and leverage things like the pandemic EBT, which gives students on free and reduced lunch access, an EBT card with the value of the free school breakfast and lunch reimbursement rates for the days that schools are closed. Really begin to shift those things to being able to be really user-friendly and not leaving items like that behind in the age of innovation, right? It's going to be incredibly important.
We all know a ton of people that are on unemployment now, whether we did before as many, we all know a lot now. And you talk about the streamline and innovation issue, and this is one of these things that happens when whole segments of demographics end up with the same problem, or at least hit by a similar crisis and leads to problems. All of a sudden, you have people that didn't understand how screwed up the system is, not able to get their unemployment checks, and saying, my God, this is really messed up. And talk a little bit about how important it is to streamline these things and make them user-friendly at every level.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. I really think that that is going to be our incredible challenge, right? We literally saw sites closed down. There are individuals who say that they are still trying to talk to someone, to get in touch with someone. And I think that what's really interesting is the fact that I'm not certain that even as that system, the infrastructure for our IT was really built up the way in which it needs to be even before this, right? So 81 million jobs in America pay $20 or less, right? According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So this includes those individuals who are now our heroes. It includes cashiers and truck drivers and food service workers and nursing assistants and janitors. These are the folks who are on the front line right now, but also all of those additional individuals who are not and unfortunately wound up being now unemployed. So really making certain that we're paying attention to what are we investing in over time? Have we built up our infrastructure to ensure that it has the breadth and the capacity in order to handle those individuals who we know, we have the statistics, Scott, right? We know how many individuals fall within that space. And so if these individuals, also described as ALICE, asset limited, income constrained, but employed, we understand that if they miss a paycheck, if there's a household emergency that goes wrong, that they're in trouble. But there had not been a forethought of, and what if that goes wrong for all 81 million of those individuals in those jobs? So there has to be some foresight that understands that these are really user programs. And so with our end user in mind, with the vast amount of a true recognition of who is vulnerable, right, and really understanding that, what would we need to do in order to properly interface with them, right? Think about the folks who are just like, oh, just go online and sign up. And then think about those families I mentioned earlier, the 90% without internet access, right? So this is really something that we've got to wrap our minds around very quickly in order to ensure that those across the country who we describe as our saviors, right? That the one who is able to deliver the takeout that you order today, that next week when the restaurant says that they can no longer do this, who then gets added to that particular category of individuals who are now unemployed, right? How are we taking care of them?
No, absolutely. These are great challenges, and you know, anybody that's above a certain income level realizes almost intuitively that supporting a family at those numbers, the $30,000, $40,000 a year numbers that drive that $20 an hour paycheck and 40 hours a week is literally impossible in our country. It's not impossible. It is really, really, really hard. And then it's impossible, as you mentioned, to have any savings and sort of any safety net built up, even though you're working incredibly hard at those kinds of dollar amounts, and it's just reality. Micheline, we've got to sign off today or close up today. I want to thank you so much for your thoughts. Always brilliant, always insightful, and I just thrilled at what you and your system do to try and address some of these issues in the ways that you can. Just fantastic. Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Scott.